The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 12. The Sacred Marriage. Section 2. The Marriage of the Gods. At Babylon, the imposing sanctuary of Bel rose like a pyramid above the city in a series of 8 towers or stories, planted one on the top of the other. On the highest tower, reached by an ascent which wound about all the rest, there stood a spacious temple, and in the temple a great bed, magnificently draped and cushioned, with a golden table beside it. In the temple no image was to be seen, and no human being passed the night there, save a single woman, whom, according to the Chaldean priests, the god chose from among all the women of Babylon. They said that the deity himself came into the temple at night and slept in the great bed. And the woman, as a consort of the god, might have no intercourse with mortal man. At Thebes in Egypt a woman slept in the temple of Ammon as the consort of the god, and, like the human wife of Baal at Babylon, she was said to have no commerce with a man. In Egyptian texts she is often mentioned as the divine consort, and usually she was no less a personage than the queen of Egypt herself. For, according to the Egyptians, their monarchs were actually begotten by the god Ammon, who assumed for the time being the form of the reigning king, and in that disguise had intercourse with the queen. The divine procreation is carved and painted in great detail on the walls of 2 of the oldest temples in Egypt, those of Deir el-Bahari and Luxor. And the inscriptions attached to the paintings leave no doubt as to the meaning of the scenes. At Athens the god of the vine, Dionysus, was annually married to the queen, and it appears that the consummation of the divine union, as well as the espousals, was enacted at the ceremony. But whether the part of the god was played by a man or an image we do not know. We learn from Aristotle that the ceremony took place in the old official residence of the king, known as the cattle stall, which stood near the Prytaneum or town hall on the northeastern slope of the Acropolis. The object of the marriage can hardly have been any other than that of ensuring the fertility of the vines and other fruit trees of which Dionysus was the god. Thus both in form and in meaning the ceremony would answer to the nuptials of the king and queen of May. In the great mysteries solemnized at Eleusis in the month of September, the union of the sky god Zeus with the corn goddess Demeter appears to have been represented by the union of the Hierophant with the priestess of Demeter, who acted the parts of god and goddess. But their intercourse was only dramatic or symbolical, for the Hierophant had temporarily deprived himself of his virility by an application of hemlock. The torches having been extinguished, the pair descended into a murky place, while the throng of worshippers awaited in anxious suspense the result of the mystic congress, on which they believed their own salvation to depend. After a time the Hierophant reappeared, and in a blaze of light silently exhibited to the assembly a reaped ear of corn, the fruit of the divine marriage. Then in a loud voice he proclaimed, "Queen Brimo has brought forth the sacred boy Brimus," by which he meant, "The mighty one has brought forth the mighty." The corn mother in fact had given birth to her child, the corn, and her travail pangs were enacted in the sacred drama. This revelation of the reaped corn appears to have been the crowning act of the mysteries. Thus through the glamour shed round these rites by the poetry and philosophy of later ages there still looms, like a distant landscape through a sunlit haze, a simple rustic festival designed to cover the wide Eleusinian plain with a plenteous harvest by wedding the goddess of the corn to the sky god, who fertilized the bare earth with genial showers. Every few years the people of Plataea, in Boeotia, held a festival called the Little Daedala, at which they felled an oak tree in an ancient oak forest. Out of the tree they carved an image, and having dressed it as a bride, they set it on a bullock cart with a bridesmaid beside it. The image seems then to have been drawn to the bank of the river Asopus and back to the town, attended by a piping and dancing crowd. Every 60 years the festival of the great Daedala is celebrated by all the people of Boeotia. And at it all the images, 14 in number, which had accumulated at the lesser festivals, were dragged on wains in procession to the river Asopus and then to the top of Mount Cithaeron, where they were burnt on a great pyre. The story told to explain the festivals suggests that they celebrated the marriage of Zeus to Hera, represented by the oaken image in bridal array. In Sweden every year a life-size image of Frey, the god of fertility, both animal and vegetable, was drawn about the country in a wagon attended by a beautiful girl who was called the god's wife. She acted also as his priestess in his great temple at Uppsala. Wherever the wagon came with the image of a god and his blooming young bride, the people crowded to meet them and offered sacrifices for a fruitful year. Thus the custom of marrying gods either to images or to human beings was widespread among the nations of antiquity. The ideas on which such a custom is based are too crude to allow us to doubt that the civilized Babylonians, Egyptians, and Greeks inherited it from their barbarous or savage forefathers. This presumption is strengthened when we find rites of a similar kind in vogue among the lower races. Thus, for example, we are told that once upon a time the water axe of the Malmyz district in Russia were distressed by a series of bad harvests. They did not know what to do, but at last concluded that their powerful but mischievous god Keremet must be angry at being unmarried. So a deputation of elders visited the warty axe of Kerai and came to an understanding with them on the subject. Then they returned home, laid in a large stock of brandy, and having made ready a gaily decked wagon and horses, they drove in procession with bells ringing, as they do when they are fetching home a bride, to the sacred grove at Kerai. There they ate and drank merrily all night, and next morning they cut a square piece of turf in the grove and took it home with them. After that, though it fared well with the people of Malmyz, it fared ill with the people of Kerai. For in Malmyz the bread was good, but in Kerai it was bad. Hence the men of Kerai who had consented to the marriage were blamed and roughly handled by their indignant fellow villagers. What they meant by this marriage ceremony, says the writer who reports it is not easy to imagine. Perhaps, as Bechteru thinks, they meant to marry Keremet to the kindly and fruitful Mukilsin, the earth wife, in order that she might influence him for good. When wells are dug in Bengal, a wooden image of a god is made and married to the goddess of water. Often the bride destined for the god is not a log or a cloud, but a living woman of flesh and blood. The Indians of a village in Peru have been known to marry a beautiful girl, about 14 years of age, to a stone shaped like a human being, which they regarded as a god, Huzaka. All the villagers took part in the marriage ceremony, which lasted 3 days, and was attended with much revelry. The girl thereafter remained a virgin and sacrificed to the idol for the people. They showed her the utmost reverence and deemed her divine. Every year about the middle of March, when the season for fishing with the dragnet began, the Algonquins and Hurons married their nets to two young girls, aged 6 or 7. At the wedding feast the net was placed between the two maidens, and was exhorted to take courage and catch many fish. The reason for choosing the brides so young was to make sure that they were virgins. The origin of the custom is said to have been this. One year, when the fishing season came round, the Algonquins cast their nets as usual, but took nothing. Surprised at their want of success, they did not know what to make of it, till the soul or genius, Oki, of the net appeared to them in the likeness of a tall well-built man, who said to them in a great passion, "I have lost my wife and I cannot find one who has known no other man but me. That is why you do not succeed, and why you never will succeed till you give me satisfaction on this head." So the Algonquins held a council and resolved to appease the spirit of the net by marrying him to two such very young girls that he could have no ground of complaint on that score for the future. They did so, and the fishing turned out all that could be wished. The thing got wind among their neighbors the Hurons, and they adopted the custom. A share of the catch was always given to the families of the two girls who acted as brides of the net for the year. The Aurons of Bengal worship the earth as a goddess, and annually celebrate her marriage with the sun god Tham, at the time when the Satyldal tree is in blossom. The ceremony is as follows. All bathe, then the men repair to the sacred grove, Sana, while the women assemble at the house of the village priest. After sacrificing some fowls to the sun god and the demon of the grove, the men eat and drink. The priest is then carried back to the village on the shoulders of a strong man. Near the village, the women meet the men and wash their feet. With beating of drums and singing, dancing, and jumping, all proceed to the priest's house, which has been decorated with leaves and flowers. Then the usual form of marriage is performed between the priest and his wife, symbolizing the supposed union between sun and earth. After the ceremony, all eat and drink and make merry. They dance and sing obscene songs, and finally indulge in the vilest orgies. The object is to move the Mother Earth to become fruitful. Thus the sacred marriage of the sun and earth, personated by the priest and his wife, is celebrated as a charm to ensure the fertility of the ground. And for the same purpose, on the principle of homeopathic magic, the people indulge in licentious orgy. It deserves to be remarked that the supernatural being to whom women are married is often a god or spirit of water. Thus Makassa, the god of the Victorian Yamza Lake, who was propitiated by the Baganda every time they undertook a long voyage, had virgins provided for him to serve as his wives. Like the Vestals, they were bound to chastity, but unlike the Vestals, they seem to have been often unfaithful. The custom lasted until Mangos converted to Christianity. The Akakaya of British East Africa worship the snake of a certain river, and at intervals of several years they marry the snake god to women, but especially to young girls. For this purpose, huts are built by order of the medicine men, who they consummate the sacred marriage with the credulous female devotees. If the girls do not repair at the huts of their own accord in sufficient numbers, they are seized and dragged thither to the embraces of the deity. The offspring of these mystic unions appears to be fathered on God, Ngai. Certainly there are children among the Akakaya who pass for children of God. It is said that once, when the inhabitants of Kalyanburu, an East Indian island, were threatened with destruction by a swarm of crocodiles, they ascribed the misfortune to a passion which the prince of the crocodiles had conceived for a certain girl. Accordingly, they compelled the damsel's father to dress her in bridal array and deliver her over to the clutches of her crocodile lover. A usage of the same sort is reported to have prevailed in the Maldive Islands before the conversion of the inhabitants to Islam. The famous Arab traveller Ibn Battuta has described the custom and the manner in which it came to an end. He was assured by several trustworthy natives, whose names he gives, that when the people of the islands were idolaters, there appeared to them every month an evil spirit among the jinn, who came from across the sea in the likeness of a ship full of burning lamps. The rent of the inhabitants, as soon as they perceived him, was to take a young virgin, and, having adorned her, to lead her to a heathen temple that stood on the shore, with a window looking out to sea. There they left the damsel for the night, and when they came back in the morning they found her a maid no more, and dead. Every month they drew lots, and he upon whom the lot fell gave up his daughter to the genie of the sea. The last of the maidens thus offered to the demon was rescued by a pious Berber, who by reciting the Quran succeeded in driving the genie back into the sea. Ibn Battuta's narrative of the demon lover and his mortal brides closely resembles a well-known type of folk tale, of which versions have been found from Japan and Annam in the east to Senegambia, Scandinavia, and Scotland in the west. The story varies in details from people to people, but as commonly told it runs thus. A certain country is infested by a men-headed serpent, dragon, or other monster, which would destroy the whole people if a human victim, generally a virgin, were not delivered up to him periodically. Many victims have there perished, and at last it has fallen to the lot of the king's own daughter to be sacrificed. She is exposed to the monster, but the hero of the tale, generally a young man of humble birth, interposes in her behalf, slays the monster, and receives the hand of the princess as his reward. In many of the tales, the monster, who is sometimes described as a serpent, inhabits the water of a sea, a lake, or a fountain. In other versions, he is a serpent or dragon who takes possession of the springs of water, and only allows the water to flow or the people to make use of it on condition of receiving a human victim. It would probably be a mistake to dismiss all these tales as pure inventions of the storyteller. Rather, we may suppose that they reflect a real custom of sacrificing girls or women to be the wives of water spirits, who are very often conceived as great serpents or dragons.